As progressive and critical care nurses, we are required to assess and chart our patients' sedation levels. And while there are many ways to assess sedation, the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale, aka RASS, is the most widely adopted, especially in the critical care setting. The RASS is a 10-point scale ranging from +4 for combative agitation down to -5 for a patient who is unresponsive to nauseous stimuli. And this is an important tool because it gets us all on the same page when talking about sedation. We can all communicate clearly about a patient's level of sedation so as to achieve all the good things like decreased ventilator time and decreased delirium. I was recently part of a transition in practice program for nurses who are transitioning from acute care to the ICU. And while I've actually used RASS as a progressive care nurse, its importance really came into focus when I started managing critically ill patients who were intubated and on sedative drips. So the craziest thing happened. I went to chart my patient sedation scores, but found that they differed wildly from the nurses who charted before me. And to be honest, I was getting a lot of -3s and -4s, which wasn't good because the nurses before me were charting -1s and -2s. And the parameters for my drips were, you guessed it, to maintain a patient at a RASS of 0 to -2. So this put me in such an awkward spot. And as a new to critical care nurse, I didn't want to rock the boat. But at the same time, from hosting this podcast, I knew the grave dangers of over-sedation and delirium, and that we were setting our patients up for terrible outcomes if we continued to allow our patients to maintain such deep levels of sedation. So, what did I do? I phoned a friend. I called up Kaylee Dayton, who is a critical care nurse practitioner and my go-to person for all things early mobility, delirium prevention, and ICU liberation. Kaylee and I recorded our conversation about some of my burning questions as a newbie in the ICU. And this episode will cover what nurses need to know about RASS, why it's important, and how to accurately score our patients' agitation or sedation levels. No more guessing here, because by the end of this episode, you will feel confident in your RASS assessment and have some added insight for how to use this score to promote better outcomes. The second part of our discussion I will save for next week's episode, which will be about spontaneous awakening trials. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school.
Hey listeners, I'm going to be sharing some career updates in a little bit, but as I've been exploring new nursing opportunities, I am grateful as ever to have PCCN certification under my belt. It's been an objective accomplishment that strengthens my resume. Earning my PCCN opened doors to my first progressive care job, helped me climb the clinical ladder, and honestly led to salary increases, not to mention quarterly bonuses. I have Nicole Kupchick to thank. Her online courses and practice questions guided me to pass the PCCN exam. If you don't know Nicole, she has a gift for teaching complex concepts in memorable ways. Nicole wants to support you on your CCRN, PCCN, and CMC certification journeys, and is offering my listeners 20% off all of her products. Just use the code UPMYGAME20 at NicoleKupchickConsulting.com. So if you're looking to boost your skills and career, don't miss this discount. Invest in yourself and your nursing excellence.
I'm a nurse practitioner. I started my career as a nurse 14 years ago in an awake and walk-in ICU where almost all patients were allowed to wake up after intubation and mobilize shortly after. It's a high acuity medical surgical ICU. It had one of the highest COVID units during the pandemic. Most patients really were, even during COVID, awake and walking in their rooms while intubated on ventilators, even on high settings. So that was my experience for the first 2 years of my career. And then I became a travel nurse and I was very shocked to find a completely different practice in the 11 other ICUs I worked in, where patients were automatically sedated upon intubation, no matter the reason they were intubated. I started to ask questions and I was treated like I was insane. So I ended up just going with what the normal practices were. After those few years, I returned back to that awake and walk-in ICU during grad school and really started to dissect why there was such a huge contrast in practices, but especially outcomes. Why were most of my patients successfully extubating, walking out the doors and going home, when the previous 2 years during travel nursing, most of my patients ended up with tracheostomies and had very different outcomes, and they were harder to take care of and not nearly as fun. So this exploration led me to really dive into the ABCDF bundle, the research behind delirium mobility, and that led me to now be a consultant. I help teams master the ABCDF bundle and become awake and walking ICUs.
As I mentioned earlier, Kaylee, I'm new to the ICU. I do come with 8 years of experience in med-surg, tele, intermediate care. But two things have come up for me that have been confusing. And, you know, I always think if it's confusing for me, it's probably confusing for other nurses too. I was wondering if you could speak about the RAS score, which is a measurement of agitation. You know, I was actually using it in acute and intermediate care as well, but it's kind of taken on this whole new significance in the ICU. It's something we're assessing every few hours. And I've found that there's not much consistency in nurses assessing RAS. If you had the chance to go in front of a classroom of nurses and give your spiel on how to do a good RAS assessment, like, I would love to hear what you have to say.
Absolutely. And anytime we teach the how to something, we should preface with the why. So this Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale is to measure psychomotor activity. It is how arousable they are or how sedated they are. What we culturally have perceived the RAS to be is an anxiety scale. Now, obviously, certain psychomotor activities can be rooted in anxiety. It can reveal anxiety. It can be a symptom of anxiety. But because we've believed it to be an anxiety scale, that's influenced how we sedate patients. For example, we've believed that if a patient is not moving, they're not having anxiety. So if we sedate a patient, we've treated their anxiety. When really, when you talk to survivors, they were still writhing in delirium under sedation. They were still terrified and confused. They were still aware of their environment, of the endotracheal tube. They still had pain. They were still in there, and they were so anxious. They were just chemically restrained and unable to express their anxiety. So it's really important to understand what's happening to the patient when they have a low RAS score, or recognize that we don't know what's happening to the patient. We don't know what they're experiencing, but what we do know is that just because they have a low RAS score, just because they're not showing their anxiety, does not mean that they do not have anxiety or agitation, fear, confusion, and especially pain. So this is why it's really important to have a good grasp on the RAS, because how we sedate patients greatly impacts their outcomes. So a zero on the RAS score should be most of our goals for most patients.
Even intubated patients?
Yes, intubated patients, yeah. So again, zooming out, we're talking about ICU liberation. ICU liberation is the pathway to implement the ABCDEF bundle. And the very goal of the bundle is to have patients that are more awake, cognitively engaged, and physically active to have the ability to express their unmet physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. So you want them awake, autonomous, engaged, moving, communicative. Now, if patients are negative two, can they really write on a whiteboard? Can they text with their phones? Can they use the call light? Can they tell you what they need, right? So a negative one on the RAS score is when they respond to voice. You don't have to touch them. You just say, "Hi, Betty." And they open their eyes for more than 10 seconds. And then maybe drift off. Zero is obviously when they're spontaneously awake and they're just chilling there. in bed, right? Or in the chair, wherever they are. But negative one is when they keep their eyes open for over 10 seconds. Negative two is when they open their eyes to voice, but they close them before 10 seconds are up. Negative three is when you talk to them and they maybe like raise their eyebrows and maybe open their eyes, but they don't make eye contact. So negative one, negative two is light sedation. Negative three is moderate sedation. Some studies consider still negative three to be deep sedation. Negative four is when you have to touch them to get them to respond. And that response can be a flinch, it can be eye-opening. Negative five is when they do not respond to noxious stimuli. So you can give them a sternal rub and they still don't open their eyes. What I've seen as a consultant when I go and train teams is that even our seasoned nurses with the best of intentions and all the expertise in so many things, when they go to assess a RAS, and I relate to this because I did this as well, when you approach a patient, especially to introduce yourself, you are touching them. You're saying, hi, I'm your nurse. So caring and compassionate, you're connecting with your patient, right? But when you do that and assess a RAS off of that, you're missing a big piece. Just because you touch them and they open their eyes or kind of moved in response does not mean that they're a negative two or a negative one. It means that you don't know where they're at. You should first, when you're assessing a RAS, approach them and just use voice. Stand there, do not touch them, and say, hi, John. John, are you there? And then see how they respond, how long they keep their eyes open. Just because they open their eyes and you turn your back to go grab a med or something does not mean that you know how long they kept their eyes open for. And then if they're not responding to voice, then you need to do touch and see how much touch they need or do they respond to touch. Now, this is so important because deep sedation, which is again, negative four, negative five, some studies it's a negative three. That is an independent predictor of mortality. If patients do not respond to voice, they are twice as likely to die. It's an independent risk factor and predictor of delirium, which we talked about in our previous episodes that delirium is acute brain failure. It's an organ failure. Delirium doubles the risk of dying in the hospital. It makes patients 120 times greater, have a greater risk of having long-term cognitive impairments or a post-ICU dementia. So our goal should rarely be to have patients unresponsive to voice. Sometimes that might be necessary if they have seizures, if they have intracranial hypertension, if they cannot oxygenate with movement, if they're prone and paralyzed, then you go to a negative four, negative five, right? But recognize that it comes at a price. And we should, that doesn't mean that patient isn't appropriate for the bundle. It just means that they're at a different exception and different criteria at that time. We should still be looking at the bundle saying, okay, what's their RAS? What's their CAM score? We can't check right now, but we're going to be thinking about that because we want to look at why are they sedated? Why are they so deeply sedated? Do we still have that need for sedation? So we need to be talking to each other in our own report saying their RAS of negative two, they open their eyes to voice for over 10 seconds, maybe even specifying that so that when the next nurse comes in and now they require touch, has something changed? We should be worried about that. Did they have a stroke? Are they developing delirium, hypoactive delirium? Like that should be a warning sign of some change. If the rate on the pump didn't change, and now the nurse sees something different than what they received in report, we need to be investigating, okay, has that propofol accumulated in the adipose tissue? But if we don't do an accurate RAS, and then we don't titrate our sedation to that RAS, we're, one, setting patients up for worse outcomes, right? An organ failure, even death, longer time in the ventilator, longer time in the ICU, more ICU cord weakness, more work for the team. So it might be perceived as easier to keep them deeply sedated. It's not. Delirium can increase their time in the ICU by at least 4.77 days. Also, if you as a nurse are sedating a patient to a RAS lower than what is prescribed, so a lot of our sedation orders have a sedate to a RAS of negative one, negative two, but maybe the family finds out what a RAS score is, and they know what the RAS score should be. Now they see that the patient is actually negative four, negative five. That's a liability for the nurse. That is giving more medication than prescribed. You would never give an extra gram of vancomycin. But when we sedate past a prescribed RAS score, we're giving more medication than prescribed. That's outside the scope of practice for an RN. And it may be considered, you know, malpractice. I hate, you know, using that word, but we need to be aware because we need to protect ourselves, right? So if patients have worse outcomes and we see, for example, nurse charts a negative 2, but we see physician charts that the patient was unarousable, or physical therapy comes in to work with the patient and they say they were unarousable to voice. For me, I've done medical reviews and that raises a bunch of red flags. Someone's not charting accurately here. Something's wrong. If the patient was not able to engage in physical therapy because they were too sedated, something happened. If that sedation order was for 0 to negative 1, but now they're negative 3 and it's really hard for them to engage with physical therapy, but that they're not charred as a negative 3, like there are so many liabilities within that. So it's really important. And then on the flip side, so we talked about the negative side of RAS, the sedated side. It's important to understand the positive sides too. So RASA plus 1 is when they're like fidgety, kind of restless. Negative 2 is when they're getting like more movement. Maybe they're banging on the side rails. They're like slamming their hands or their legs on the bed, right? That's restless. Some studies show plus 2 and up is agitation. Some studies say just plus 3 and plus 4 is agitation. But sometimes we use the word agitation to describe when they're uncomfortable, when they're anxious. That doesn't mean that they're agitated. Agitated is when they're doing more psychomotor activity. So dangerous behavior is when you enter into a plus 3, which is when they're trying to pull out their lines or their tubes. That's plus 3. That's what we're worried about, right? That's dangerous behavior. Plus 4 is when they're trying to cause harm to themselves or to the clinicians. So that's why we see delirium increases workplace violence, because you get so much confusion and agitation from the delirium, and then that's when they lash out. They're confused and they're agitated. They're scared because they think you're trying to kidnap them. That's why they hit clinicians, right? So when it comes to sedation, an indication for sedation in that sense would be a RAS of plus 3 or plus 4, when they're at risk of hurting themselves with line and tube removals or hurting clinicians, right? That's when you use sedation to do some chemical restraint. But then we need to be looking at what's the RAS goal with that. Do we want to sedate them so that they can't mobilize? Or do we want to sedate them to the point of being a RAS of 0? I'm okay with a plus 1 so that they can then mobilize. Can we use some light sedation to get them safe enough to then treat the cause of that agitation? So yes, obviously when they're a RAS of plus 1, plus 2, you're seeing signs of a lot of things. Just because they're moving doesn't mean that they're uncomfortable. They could be scared, confused. They could have pain. So when you see a RASA plus 1 or plus 2, ask them, talk to them. What happens right now is that we are so trained to perceive patients as being asleep and comfortable when they're at a low RAS that we assume that if they're at a higher RAS, that it's just the endotracheal tube. But we can't alter that at the moment, so we'd better make them comfortable and put them back down to a lower RAS. And if we don't see those signs of discomfort and anxiety and even agitation, we've fixed the problem. It's better to be, quote, sleeping than to be aware of the endotracheal tube. Now, coming from an awake and walking ICU, most of my patients were a RAS of 0, maybe negative 1 if they're sleeping or if they are a little bit delirious. Sometimes if they're a plus 1, plus 2, we use that momentum to mobilize them. We don't just sedate them for that. But it's not until they really got crazy and dangerous that we then used sedation to keep them, everyone, safe. But we never sedated them beyond being able to mobilize them. We didn't want to take away their ability to communicate. We couldn't treat the underlying cause. So sometimes you'd be surprised and amazed what patients tell you when you give them a pen and paper. If you don't automatically run back to sedation when you see some restlessness, some discomfort, give them pen and paper, said, what do you need? What are you expecting? Are you in pain? What do you need? Okay, sometimes they'll ask, I need to poop. That's what's causing it. Now, was sedation going to fix that? Sometimes they'll say, where is my child? They're panicked, being like, I don't know where I'm at. And I maybe in their delirium, they thought something was happening to their kids. You don't know what those questions are. I remember one patient had muscular dystrophy, and she could just barely write with her hand, and she had aspiration pneumonia while she was intubated. And she was really worried because the father of her child was not a safe person. And if she wasn't there, was he going to get custody? And there was this whole battle with all the legalities. She was able to navigate that and tell us what she needed and what was going on and how to keep her and what instructions to give her family. And her anxiety immediately decreased. So sedation never would have fixed that. It would have worsened it because she would probably be more concerned and more confused, right? So when they're a breath of plus one, plus two, that doesn't mean you need to run back to sedation. It means you got to figure out what's going on. If it's pain, treat it, then reevaluate. Therapy communication, I think, sometimes is scoffed at in the ICU because we're like, it's life or death. We don't have time for that. No, this could be life or death for them. So one patient said one time that they had chest pain. So they were uncomfortable from the chest pain. But because the nurse gave them pen and paper, they were able to relay that. They got a chest x-ray. The patient had a large pneumothorax. Right as they were looking at that image on the machine outside the room, the patient coded. They knew exactly what had caused it. They were able to intervene while they were coding and got the patient back. That, not sedating him because he was RASA plus one or plus two, saved his life. So this is why it's really important to understand RAS. When we use the word agitated and we relay that in rounds or especially in report, we say the patient was agitated. But we don't ask, well, why were they agitated or what was their RAS? I want to understand, are they dangerous? Do I need to be protect myself, right? When I do an awakening trial, do I need to know, were they trying to punch you? Or were they shifting in bed and showing discomfort? Because I can deal with that. Like I can investigate, we can work with that, right? But do I need to know how dangerous this is when I go to approach an awakening trial? Do I need to have physical and occupational therapy with me because they were so delirious during that awakening trial that now we need to treat delirium? But we're not asking questions. We're like, oh yeah, they're agitated. Yeah, I'm not going to touch that sedation. So here's an example. I was working with a team a few weeks ago. There was a patient that had overdose on fentanyl and Xanax, and he had gross aspiration, pneumonia. He was a large, obese man. So I walk in to just tour the unit to do gap analysis, and I'm seeing that his propofol is at 50 mics, and I'm asking questions. And they said, well, he was really agitated last night. So he'd come in the day before, I think probably afternoon, had worsening respiratory distress, was intubated overnight, and he was coming out thrashing. And so they were really scared. They heard from the night shift that he was thrashing, and he's a big guy, polysubstance abuse, right? You've got all these labels going on, and you don't want to put clinicians at risk, right? Also, he was on a PEEP of 16 and 100%. So he's got sick lungs, right? So we're worried about his lungs. We're worried about his safety. We can't handle his thrashing, right? Okay, but I also looked at a different perspective. He's got sick lungs. He's got aspiration pneumonia. A bronchoscopy is only going to get so deep into the lungs. He needs pulmonary toileting. He needs to sit up. Also, he's obese. He's got a large abdomen. Is his PEEP ever going to go down with the abdomen, with the pressure from his abdomen? So if we're sedating for a ventilator setting, that sedation is never going to come off. Also, will his ventilator settings really lower if we let that aspiration just sit in his lungs? What if we sat him up, relieve the pressure on his abdomen, let his lungs inflate, let him cough, let him mobilize that vomit in his lungs? Would that help? Next question was, why is he thrashing? Is he delirious? Well, he was just intubated overnight. Yes, he's getting propofol, but that's a short amount of time to have it. But look at his history. He's addicted. And we didn't know exactly to what. We knew he was a fentanyl user, but also benzodiazepines maybe. So is he withdrawing? He overdosed, but they probably gave him Narcan. They reversed it. So now is he withdrawing? So I pitched this to the team. They thought I was insane, but they went for it because that's what I was there for, to show them new tricks, right? So we started oxycodone down the feeding tube, Klonopin down the feeding tube to cover for his withdrawal. I didn't want them taking sedation off until we knew that he was not going to be withdrawing, because there's nothing you can do with that. You can't have him be a RAS of plus three, plus four, right? Not safe. And he's at high risk of self-extubating when he's withdrawing, right? So we covered that. Now, remember, his propofol still going at 50, but I was nervous to like take that off until we had coverage for his withdrawal, right? A few hours later, I have him take it off. He doesn't respond. He's a RAS of negative five. Now, I asked, what is his RAS order for? And it was for negative three. They didn't reevaluate that. They didn't necessarily change anything because they'd gotten from report that he was thrashing and they were scared. But if I hadn't been there, he wouldn't have even had an awakening trial for another like 18 hours. He's obese. that propofol at higher rates was just settling into his adipose tissue. So it took him 6 hours to metabolize that out. Now, if that had run for another few days at that rate, which it likely would have been, he was also getting Versed drips on top of it, he would have been so delirious, so deconditioned. That was another concern. They're like, well, we want to keep the staff safe. But my question was, how safe is it for a staff to move a 350-pound flaccid body? He was walking yesterday, or at least the night before, right? He was in a motel, but he was independently moving. We want to preserve that physical function, not just for him, but for the staff. And also, he's probably going to be on the ventilator for a while because his lungs are so sick right now. He's at high risk of developing ARDS from the aspiration pneumonia. Like, we do not want to set him up to have a tracheostomy. He's already got, obviously, psychosocial problems at baseline. He doesn't need a sedation-induced brain injury, more trauma on baseline. We don't know why he's self-medicating, right? So just look at this whole picture of, is that RAS really safe for him? That's going to double his risk of dying. If the order is for -3, which I would like to see more of a -2, -1, right, for him, and then eventually be a 0. But if that's really the order, is that within your scope to have him at a -5 right now? And now, here's the thing. Maybe it was a -3 overnight, but it accumulated. So then it was a -5. But because there wasn't accurate RAS assessment being done, they're just looking at him and like, well, his eyes are closed. He's probably -3 or probably -2. It wasn't accurate documentation. It was outside their scope. It was putting the patient at more risk. It set him up to, because we brought in physical and occupational therapy when we took in that sedation, thinking, okay, maybe he'll wake up right away. So that wasted the PT and OT's time. That took away an opportunity to mobilize the patient that they could have used, and they could have set him up for a much easier night. Because if they'd mobilized him and helped him acclimate to the tube and made him comfortable and treated the anxiety he was having, their night would have been different. But what instead happened was day shift gets off. The patient's still metabolizing that propofol. It's off, but he's not doing anything. Night shift comes on. Now, what, 11, 12 o'clock at night, he comes out thrashing. Now, I don't think he was a full RAS of +3 or +4. I think he was a RAS of +2. He was banging on the side rails. So not dangerous, but stressful. Right? It's really stressful to have a patient look uncomfortable. They don't know what to do. They're not used to it, right? They're used to their patients being sedated. He's wanting to write. They don't even have a pen and paper in the room. You know, just lots of difficult things happen. So they end up giving Versed drips overnight or pushes overnight, which was not, that goes against the ADF bundle. You don't want to be giving benzodiazepines, but they were, I don't know why they didn't do Presidex, would have been my preference. Point is, coming in the morning and he's like a RAS of +1. And so physical and occupational therapy can finally work with him. I sit him up. Oh, and at that point, he's saturating like 89-90%, like kind of bouncing between the two while laying there supine on high ventilator settings. So everyone's nervous. But there's nothing in the research that says that you can't mobilize patients in high ventilator settings as long as they're saturating. So it could have gone two ways. It could have, he could have desatted upon sitting up, but I was pretty confident because of what I've seen. Usually it goes up because their lungs can function better. So there's new studies coming out that being vertical, being upright, has the same benefit to VQ mismatch as being supine. So my thought was, proning him was going to be tricky. What if we got him up? Would we see the same benefit? And we did. He sat up, and his saturations went up to 93, 94. And you could see the tension just release from his shoulders. He went from being super grumpy to, okay, give me a pen and paper. I can write. Let's talk about this. He got up to a chair. So that was on a Friday I left. He was up in a chair, awake. They started to decrease his ventilator settings. He was just kind of back between the bed and the chair, getting himself to the chair, didn't need a ton of people, wasn't unsafe. By Monday, he was extubated, walking around the unit. Now, the other option was to prone and paralyze him for his ventilator settings. That would have taken him on a completely different course and would have been weeks on the ventilator, weeks and months in rehabilitation. It just would have been a totally different story. But because we looked at what is his RAS, what's his goal, what's the cause of these symptoms that we're seeing, we were able to customize the care to keep him compliant with the bundle, which is awake, communicative, autonomous, mobile. That's why the RAS is so important. That's how we use it.
Do you think that the nurses who were taking care of him were accurately measuring the RAS score?
No. And that's not on the nurses. I mean, it is. I mean, that is a nurse's responsibility, right? I also teach entire teams to do the RAS score because I want everyone to be able to be speaking the same language. But right now, usually only the nurses know the RAS scores, right? But this is a common problem throughout the entire community. One study from Brazil showed that 70% of the patients were sedated beyond the RASS goal of 0 to negative 3. 70%. I had a nursing student go out and do a survey in the two ICUs where she was capstoning. She found that, so she compared the prescribed RASS to the charted RASS to what she was observing. So she was going very literal. The RASS is supposed to be objective, right? But we've turned it into something subjective, right? So she looked at it very objectively, exactly like I described it, right? Do they open their eyes to voice? How long do their eyes stay open? Do they need touch? Do they respond, right? So she found that 52% of patients were over-sedated. So over half of their patients had inaccurate RASS scores, and they were sedated past the prescribed RASS, which again is very dangerous. 38% were 1 point away from the target RASS goal. 62% were 2 points or more away from the target RASS goal. So their negative twos were usually negative fours or negative fives. And it's an independent predictor of mortality. So are we increasing mortality with doing inaccurate and inadequate RASS assessments? Yes, absolutely. That's no one's intention. That's the reality of it.
And to clarify a point, a RASS score is independent of the use of sedatives, right? Like you can do an accurate RASS score on someone who is not on a sedative.
Yep, we use it to guide sedation, but we should be doing it on all of our patients. So when we have neurological changes, we need to be able to monitor that. So you have maybe stroke patients that are like a little bit drowsy or they're delirious. Now they're unresponsive to touch. Like we need to capture that in our documentation and in our assessments, right? This can change within our own shifts. We need to also relay that to the next clinicians or in rounds and be able to come and say, hey, they were negative one when I started my shift. Now they're negative five. Something's going on.
Okay. And can you do an accurate RASS on someone who is a stroke patient, right? I'm asking this because I had a patient who had a stroke and she had uncal herniation and she was very, very drowsy. And like, is this an appropriate time to use RASS?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And so when we just say people patients are sleepy, kind of just kind of accept that as a medical term. But we need to be using RASS because sleepy can be negative one and negative five, but those can be very different presentations. And if they change, something's caused it to change.
Kaylee's breakdown of how to properly assess the RASS highlights how critical clear communication is in healthcare, especially for complex topics like neurological status. So when nurses, doctors, and other team members use consistent language in assessment tools like the RASS, it ensures that everyone is on the same page regarding a patient's sedation level. As Kaylee emphasized, vague terms like sleepy can mean anything from a RASS of minus one to minus five, whereas being specific about a patient's response to verbal and tactile stimulation makes their status crystal clear. To wrap things up, a proper RASS assessment starts with an observation. If your patient is alert and calm, they score zero. If the patient is sedated, approach them and without touching, don't touch, say their name and ask them to make eye contact with you. If they make eye contact with you for more than 10 seconds, they are minus one. If they make eye contact with you for less than 10 seconds, they're minus two. If they respond but didn't make direct eye contact, that's a minus three. Now, if they don't respond to verbal stimulation, next you want to apply physical stimulation, such as a sternal rub. If they respond to that, they're a minus four. And if they don't respond to nauseous stimuli, they're a minus five. Now, as you may have noticed, we haven't really talked about the agitated, the plus one to plus four spectrum of the RASS. And that's because we don't really see it used all that much because we aren't assigning goals to agitation like we are to sedation. But with that little caveat out of the way, if a patient is anxious appearing but not really doing anything, that's a plus one. If they are anxious with non-purposeful movement or having ventilator dyssynchrony, that's a plus two. If they're more than that, pulling out lines and tubes, that's a plus 3. And if they are overtly combative to self or staff, that's a plus 4. All right, that's all for today's episode. If you've listened this far, I assume you got a lot of value out of it. So please do me a favor, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Spotify. These ratings really help me to grow the show so that I can continue to provide high-value content for you. Until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.